Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Lost Generation, Outside of the Mainstream. My name is William Hooker. I am a musician, poet, and part of this generation of artists. My goal with this podcast, which is being broadcast on its own YouTube channel and my website, williamhooker.com, is to introduce you to many of the musical artists that are outside of the mainstream and have made important artistic contributions to our culture. I have also interviewed producers of the music and many fans and supporters of this work. My guests are sharing what makes this art form unique and significant. I hope these conversations will inspire you to listen to the music, which may change you and the way you view music, which again is outside of the mainstream.
Today, I am interviewing Dick Griffin, trombonist, composer, and visual artist, as well as Warren Smith, drummer, composer, and band leader. For the rest of the summer, we will be having one interview per month. We will resume our regular schedule of two interviews beginning in September 2019.
This is The Lost Generation, Outside of the Mainstream. This is a story that needs to be told. Do you think, Dick, that the contributions that we have made are meant for a wider audience?
Yes, yes, yes. I think that it's a disparity among music exposed to a different audience. I don't see why we should not even have it in the elementary schools. Because I've played so many times in elementary schools where we just did free improv. They love it. I mean, they latch in onto it. Kids, you know, they respond to it. It's just everybody tend to, how can I say it? They are taught everything. And once you expose somebody to something, they're taught. They taste it, and then they get a taste for it. But the thing that, yes, the answer is yes. We should be to our wider audience, and we should also be going to the schools with our structured systems that we've learned by college and education and master's and doctorate. And we teach that system, but then we don't teach the other side of it. That's another way of doing it. I tell you a good example, and I'm going a little bit on. I went to Michigan State and I'll do a workshop just recently. Mm-hmm. And everybody there had more technique than I did. They could play faster, cleaner, play all the transcriptions, play like JJ, play like Curtis and everything. But I asked each student, I said, I want you to play a love song, 8 bars. Just play a song that I feel that you're expressing love. Then I want you to play a song that you just won the lottery, and I want you to express that happiness. Then I want you to play a song that the most closest relative to you just passed away, and you're going to express that in 8 bars. Some kids were crying and had me crying. See, they don't teach that in school. That's what's missing in the music today. Is coming from the heart and expressing. They don't talk about it. They can't teach it. You can't teach a person to express how they feel. And it's missing in the music. And that's what the music was about. When I was there with Sun Ra, and I was there when the riots in 68. That's what Ascension and all those songs were about. and all of that stuff. That was about. That's mm-hmm. when they were screaming and hollering. They were telling a real story. They were expressing a lot of dissatisfaction about the way the political scene was going on. Mm-hmm. And they were expressing anger. You know, I remember being on a band with Archie Shepp, you know, and this is kind of funny. We were going to Philadelphia. Hammett Brewer was in the band, a lot of the guys in the band. And one of the musicians came on, and the Brewer didn't like it, and he got off the bus. He said, "This musician ain't about what we're talking about." And he was getting ready to get off, and Archie had to express, you know, explain to this guy that he was cool, he knew the language and everything. But Brewer said, this man ain't gonna tell the story I got to tell, and this ain't gonna work. So I remember that. So I'm mm-hmm. going on and on about all of that. Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. And it should be continued.
Thank you. Because mm-hmm. I think that speaking for myself, and I think that other people in my generation, mm-hmm. that's what we've been trying to do. We've been trying to widen some of the hallmarks that you guys have actually laid down for us. Mm. That's important. And I say to Warren, you didn't notice, Warren, but my mentor, a person that listened to me in the middle of the night, that used to watch me cry and talk about things that were going on in my own personal life, was Rashid Ali.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the night, we'd be talking. Mm-hmm. And I say that because what do you think are some of the contributions that my generation has made to what you actually experienced with the older cats? And I want to say those that when you look in these faces right in this room, what is that contribution that you think has been made? Because that's what I'm focusing on.
See, I grew up in Chicago, first of all, and in the 30s and the 40s, all right? Mm-hmm. And it was really, really, really compartmentalized. You could use the word segregation, whatever you want to mm-hmm. use.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. But mm-hmm. we didn't think of it like that because we had everything in that neighborhood that I lived in. We had commercial places, we had shows. My father would get up and put on his tuxedo and go to work at night, you know, in a show or a nightclub mm-hmm. or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes we'd go and pick them up at nights. So this was a whole thing that we just, well, this is a way of life.
Sure.
Now, we didn't know what was going on the north side. It was completely alien. You know, and there were some other definitions farther south out by the stockyards that was controlled by another political element. We didn't know anything about that stuff until we got out of Chicago and saw a lot of these people from different areas coming to New York and then explaining ourselves to each other outside of Chicago. You know, but Chicago was a buster, man. I mean, they had everything that New York had except the recognition of being in New York. Mm-hmm. And I remember that growing up very, very, very vividly. You know?
But now that you look at mm-hmm. now that you look at these faces that are in this room, mm-hmm. now obviously it took a minute for us to connect.
Yeah, yeah, of course, yeah, right? Yeah.
And it probably took a minute for you to connect with some of the people that I know look at you with mm-hmm. such respect. That are, because I remember our conversation we had, and you telling me, I'm such and such an age, and I told you never say that to me again. Mm-hmm. I said this, but I didn't say that in a disrespectful way. I said that in a way so that I want you to realize that you're still a beacon for drummers like myself to realize what you've done, what you've played, who you played with, and that's the only reason I opened it up with this with the Rashid Ali quote.
Yeah.
But do you feel that what we are doing and have done is also something that should be for a select few that are in our cultural dynamic? Because obviously, for some free players, we got a certain cultural dynamic. Mm-hmm. People, they're not, I don't know. And you've seen it. You've seen it.
Let me tell you, I feel like it's an all-court blitz from all directions of seeing all kinds of things. I mean, I teach, I perform, I go out and listen, you know, and it's a back and forth. Now, when I came to New York, there was a standard that Chicago saxophonists had set up, you know, and we would listen to John Coltrane, and some cats would laugh and say, you know, oh, he's practicing on the stage, or blah, blah, this and blah, blah, that. And then after a couple of years, then cats were imitating Coltrane, all right? Now, the same thing happened, Vaughn Freeman came mm-hmm. before that, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm talking about saxophone players, because my father, that was what I wanted to be, a saxophone player, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was the theatrical thing of drums with a light and a bass drum that attracted me to the drum set. But what I'm saying is all these influences were pushing me in another direction. You know, I knew I had to get out of Chicago because that was too tight, you know. I thought that New York was the answer, but it wasn't, because New York kicks everybody's ass, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? But see, I was doing jazz, I was doing blues, I was doing Broadway shows, I was doing symphony concerts. You couldn't get all that in Chicago because all of that wasn't there. You know, the whole theatrical thing, I would have missed that if I hadn't come to New York. But all these influences, at the same time, I'm listening to the cats pushing us, I hate to call it classical jazz, but us standard jazz musicians from the swing era.
Right, yeah.
And I resisted that impetus until, you know, the thing that I have now is that I fight myself every day to increase my tolerance of things that I don't know and don't understand.
Beautiful. Beautifully said. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I get excited when I hear somebody. I get excited when I hear somebody saying that.
Yeah.
Because I think you might agree, you might disagree. Right now, many of the people in their late 60s specifically, we're still bucking up against that.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
We're still really bucking up against that. You're playing with many of the people that you know they're bucking up against that inside themselves.
Yeah, oh yeah.
The music is still there, you know, the music will always be there. But there's this tension about not how free can I get, but what's wrong with you? Can't you hear this?
Yeah.
Thank you, Hill. Can't you hear? What's wrong with you? Can't you hear this? This is who I am. This is what I do. And.
Well, let me interject something into that. If I care too much what people think about what I do, then that might affect the direction of what I do. You understand? So what I try to do is connect with myself on the inside and let that come out, and then sit back and see how other people respond to it.
Okay.
You know, that might be a safe way of going along, you know, but I can't change what I've said or what I've done, you know. I mean, I throw that out and that's out there.
Beautiful. Okay.
Now, what's going to happen now? And I don't know the answer to that either.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, let me run a couple people by you, and you tell me what you think about their music. We're not talking about personal. We're not talking about attitudes. None of that. Mm-hmm. Just about the music. Tell me what you feel about the music specifically. Mm-hmm. Okay. Billy Bang.
Oh man.
Briefly.
What he does with the violin is different. You know. Now I've seen him conduct a whole string orchestra. You know, and it was mostly improvisation, and it was very typical. But when he picks up the instrument, it's like hearing the difference between Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster. You know what I mean? Because there's something that sets his approach off. There's a certain energy that he puts into what he does that a lot of other violin players didn't do. You know, now there might be some refinements, as some of them, Sanford Allen is far more accomplished virtuosic violinist, you know. But he would never think to do some of the things that Billy Bang did. And Billy Bang probably couldn't do some of the things that Sanford could do, but would never think to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm trying to combine all these things that I've heard some really wild people do and see if I can incorporate them into what I see as discipline and break my discipline.
And you mean wild in a good way?
I mean wild in a very good way, in an inspirational way.
Beautiful. Jason Wang. I'm going to throw Jason Wang at you, Dick.
Okay.
Tell me something about his music, how you feel about his music.
Well, I'm not familiar with his music as I should be, but let's go to Billy Bang. Because
No. let me throw somebody else at you.
Okay, throw somebody else at you.
Cooper Moore.
Oh, Cooper Moore. Very unique. I love the way you play. Cooper Moore, to me, is just a jewel because he's one of a kind. I don't think anybody can approach the music like he does, mm-hmm. makes the instruments, express himself the way he does.
Yes.
He is so unique and so open and so creative. I mean, I've had the experience of going, he come to my house and he played piano, we talking about music. He is one of a kind, I cannot say it. You know, like, Rahsaan, Roland Kirk, who I had the experience of playing with, is one of a kind. There's nobody going to come along and do what he did the way he did it. Cooper Moore is the same thing. He has his own unique way of expressing himself, making his instruments. He's very competent, very well, you know, he play the piano like a piano player. Mm-hmm. He play the piano like somebody who doesn't even know what the piano is about because he goes to another level of it.
Beautiful.
So, like I say, he's one of a kind. And then, how many people everybody should know about Cooper Moore.
Masahiko Kono.
Yeah.
You know Masahiko.
Yeah.
Would you tell me something about his playing?
Oh, no. Masahiko Kono, I don't know much about him. You throw the name at
me. I'm with you, Dick. I'm with you. Yeah. No, I'm with you.
I have to talk about people that are really...
Okay, then I got you.
Could I add one thing...
About Masahiko?
About Cooper Moore.
Yeah.
Okay.
I worked with Cooper Moore with... Bill Cole's ensemble, Untempered Ensemble. Mm-hmm. And his function in that particular band was to be like another drummer. He would take like an empty drum head with a brush and manipulate the pitch with his fingers while he was just playing, you know, all of other kinds of percussion instruments. I didn't even realize at the time that he was a piano player. One day I was sitting in front of a television set in front of Boston, somebody put on a tape, and I saw this cat literally tearing up his hands on the piano keys till he was leaving blood with the energy and the, you know. But not only that, what he was playing showed me a whole different Cooper Moore than this really secure, energetic force that I was accompanying and working with in this other ensemble. Uh-huh. And I said, damn, that opens up another whole... So I had to start listening to him in a different way. Because he showed me this other side that I hadn't seen before. Mm-hmm. And it was an open door to, you know...
Mm-hmm. Rashid Bakar.
How can I say... that's another drummer. And it's difficult.
I got a lot of friends.
Because he does some things that I probably would never think to do. And then I'm always looking at other drummers and thinking I would have done that and sort of what they do.
Well, what can you say about the way he plays?
It's very relaxed. Very, almost I would say conservative. I don't see him I'm talking about physically conservative. I'm not talking about
I
don't see him reaching out to extend himself physically to find something else that he's not doing right now. You know, and other than that, I think I've always seen him as a very accomplished accompanist to the people that he's worked with. I've never found any fault in the way he was working with Cecil Taylor, whoever it may have been, you know. But I couldn't see myself doing exactly the same thing, but it's interesting and I learned something from it.
I had the privilege of working with him.
Great, Cecil Taylor.
And we did a festival in Austria. What was that festival? Up on the hill.
Willison?
I know what you're talking about.
Willison. Where you see the cows eating.
Right.
It looked like they might fall. If they just tilt over, they might fall off the hill. But yeah, we had a nice thing. And that's when I played with William. William was in the band.
Rashid. That's right, yeah. William was the bass player.
But I'm talking about Rashid specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rashid.
How is that working? How are those four limbs working?
And Cecil, you know how Cecil can go way up and way down and everything, but he was always there. You know, like he never was not. In the right place at the right time. That's all I can say is, it's all about timing, and drums deal with time and support and colors, because he was very colorful with what he did, but never overshadowed, never stepped out, never got like, oh, the drum is too loud, the drum is playing too fast, or the drum is playing too slow, or the beat is, you know, he's playing behind the beat, or the tempo drops. I hate that. The worst thing in the world I've ever had happened is when the drummer let the tempo drop. And you feel, oh, boy, it's just like you're dying on the stage, you know.
but see, there's a nuance to that, too, because in every section of the country, we hear the music differently.
Right.
In the Midwest, we don't hear the top of the beat like they do in New York.
Right.
You get farther west, and they way back behind
the beat. Right.
You know? So it depends where you come up from. I've always had to fight that thing about people thinking I'm slowing down because I didn't push.
Right.
You know,
right.
So I had to learn to do that like the New York drummers do that.
Right.
You know, so those nuances are almost topical or geographically.
You're right. You're right.
I never thought about it like that. You can play.
You play right in top of right on the beat. You can play in front of the beat, or you can play behind the beat.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
and be consistent with it.
Yeah.
And then
now in Chicago, you play a lot of blues, so you play way behind the beat sometimes.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
A shuffle.
Put it back.
Yeah. The shuffle or whatever it is, but you listen to the singer singing.
Oh, okay.
You know, if they push it, then you push. But they usually crying and dragging behind, so everything's got to, so you know, like you got to be within the music.
Yeah. Let me throw another one at you, Warren. Yeah. Kalaparusha.
Wow. Now that's somebody I grew up with from the time.
Wow. Yeah.
I was six, maybe.
Tell me about his music. Tell me about Kalaparusha.
We grew up, and
about his music.
I got to get to that. I got to define it. We were not. I was the only one who was interested in jazz with this little group of people. Melvin Van Peebles, Kalaparusha, Melvin had a brother, and I had my brother, and there were other people, you know, and we all listened, so they liked rock and roll. I didn't like rock and roll. I was into jazz. Yeah. They were liking all these other things I wasn't into. But when the music went out, when I came to New York, the music hadn't gone out as far as it had. When I came back, when my brother who introduced me to these type of people, you know, like Kalaparusha.
What do you mean by these type of people?
These people like Moo Hall, the AACM in general.
Yes.
All these guys were thinking a different way. And I had been in the conservatory, you know, and playing in orchestras and all that kind of stuff. So my thing with swing was as far as I had, you know. Now all of a sudden I get introduced to somebody like Elvin Jones, or after him, Rashid. But even more importantly, I'm in my middle 30s, and I go to hear Alan Dawson in Boston, and instead he's got a little sub that's 14 years old. And I'm saying, oh, shit, I'm wasting my time. And this little sub sent me to the woodshed for 3 years, and his name was Tony Williams.
I get it.
He was 12 years old, and he scared me so bad. In my middle, I thought I knew how to play the drums, man. Wow. I said, I got to go back home and study and practice.
Do you remember this person? that really opened my mind. Do you remember Rashid Sanam?
Yeah. That name sounds familiar, but
he's with Frank Lowe. He was playing Frank Lowe. Black Beings.
Yeah.
You remember this cat? Like, well, all right then. I'm just saying because you see what I'm trying to do. I'm seeing this whole. I know where the documentation has happened. I know out of William Parker's books.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also other books. But I'm saying that because there are some people that have actually changed the course of the music, and they are unspoken. They're invisible, like Rashid Sanan, like Marvin Petillo.
Yep.
You know Marvin Petillo?
I met him out in the Kansas City recently.
Talk to me about that cat. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get back to Cal Perucci.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I get too high. All right, Cal, you know where I'm going.
We'll get back. You know.
Yes.
But these cats were all into the rock and roll and the popular music and dancing with the girls. When I went to Chicago, Cal Perucci had been to New York. When I went to New York, Cal Perucci had been here and come back. And he had started playing really outside. When he came back to New York, he and I got together in my studio and played every day for about 6 months. Maybe not on Sundays. Mm. But we would go in there, and he was bringing me outside of boom, chick-de-boom, 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 into a more expressive, because he wasn't playing the saxophone very well when he came to New York. When he came back, I mean, he had studied saxophone with my father, who taught some pretty good people, like Johnny Griffin and Gene Adams, people like that.
Right. Yeah.
But when he came back, he was into the saxophone then. And he had started studying, and all of a sudden his articulation and his technique had gotten cleaned up, and he wasn't just trying to honk and play the blues anymore. He was actually absorbing. And he made me do that with myself on the drums. You know, I mean, he gave me another kind of discipline towards, what should we call this music? Outside music.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm gonna ask Dick this. Ask Dick one more question. Mm-hmm. Dick.
Yeah.
Now I mentioned Kyle Perucci because of one thing. I want you to elaborate on, because you've probably been a witness to this. To me, one thing that we've done is bring our spiritual, and I don't mean it in a religious sense, our spiritual wherewithal and our spiritual strivings to much of this music. It didn't stop with Ascension for me.
Mm.
It started. Mm-hmm. It didn't start with Om for me. Mm-hmm. It didn't stop. It started. Mm-hmm. And then I mentioned Kyle Perucci because if somebody comes up with an album and they're the same age as us, and the album is Humility in the Light of the Creator. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, oh, snap. This is how I feel. Mm-hmm. And you've probably seen us trying to elaborate on that. Can you tell us about that contribution that we've made to this music? That it came out of the fake book. I had to memorize the fake book. I had to memorize the thing. Because I started early, but then when I started to find it as humility in the light of the Creator and that kind of a thing, it took on a whole other impact that many people, they can't relate to it for some reason. I don't know why, I don't have no reason, but they don't want to even acknowledge it. Can you explain what you saw happen?
I have to get back to Cal Perucci.
Okay.
Maurice McIntyre. Okay. I played with Maurice McIntyre in I guess the 60s or 70s. Probably around the 60s, 70s.
Yes.
Reggie Willis played bass. Maurice McIntyre. Or Alvin Fielder.
Right. Okay.
We played in Jackson, Mississippi. In elementary school, that was the first and only time my mother ever heard me play.
Wow.
I mean, jazz, you know, and concert bands and all that. First, and then it was our concert, and I was expecting, I didn't know what my mother would think, because she loved it, you know.
Wow.
It was, you know, we were playing out, and my mother was there in the audience. That's the only time she's been to a concert that's heard me play live. I remember it was Mary C. Jones Elementary School. And Alvin Field has the tape, he said he has the tape of it, but but back then, Mommy McIntyre, cool, can't play the instrument, so smooth, so connecting, and that concert rings out in my mind.
Yes.
And then, on and on and on, like Cooper Moore, like a couple of other people, are very unique in his approach, and very sincere. This is one thing I noticed about when people that really into the music, they're into the music. 10, 12 hours a day practicing. They don't even think about a day job, even though the rent might be due. They stay into the music. I remember going when I was in Chicago, and I'll give you a little history on it. When I was 19, that's when I met Sunrise. I used to go to Chicago for the summer. I was the first time I was into integrated, so-called, but it wasn't integrated, it was Southside.
The first time he was out of the South.
I let me know I was out of the South, you know. So anyway,
South Shore Country Club.
There you go, man. But it was something about that. Now, these things are standing out, but that orange juice they used to have, the homes on it, you know that? It was the orange juice that...
I know.
It had the pulp in the... It was such a good... I think it was Holmes, I think. It was Holmes. Anyway, When I first came to Chicago, I would give me some orange juice, man, because the orange juice had pulp in it. Make that long story short, that's when I met Sun Ra. Sun Ra I was 19 years old. And the story is brief, I have to tell it. Yes. My aunt Camille. Now, I'm a little guy from Jackson, and she was not going to let me get out there and get hurt in the city of Chicago, so I had a curfew. So I come out, I could go anywhere I wanted to, as long as it was daylight in Chicago, but after the night, I had to be there, and everything. So I fixed that after about a couple of weeks, because I had my uncle Walter. When I started dating with Uncle Walter, I could stay out as long as I wanted. I'd go to by the bar at 4 o'clock, and when the bar closed, me and Uncle Walter would come home. But anyway, make that long story short, I was walking in the street one day when I heard live music. I went in, wow, and I met someone, and I said, wow. He said, he was very open. I said, I play trombone. He said, well, come bring your trombone and come rehearse with us tomorrow. And we rehearsed every day, all day, from about 11 o'clock to if we had a gig that night, it would sometimes be in the Persian ballroom. That's where we were rehearsing, where Oman Jamal did this Ponciana. And they had a Persian lounge. You know what I'm talking about, right? The Persian ballroom and the Persian lounge. Mm-hmm. So in that Persian lounge, that's where we would rehearse and then play it with Sun Ra. Mm-hmm. This guy knows. And across the street was a CNC lounge, and down the street was Keith Fitzgerald lounge. Mm-hmm. And on the corner was the Wall Street, drugstore.
Walgreens. Yeah.
63rd Street in Cottage. Dorchester down the street, and then John Young had this at the
right with the trio.
I can see that in my head now.
I want to interject something.
Mm-hmm.
Studio Wiss was very, very important for my generation. Studio Wiss was very, very important for the evolution of what I feel is, for lack of other terms, free jazz. I can remember a person, I want you to elaborate on Warren specifically, because it's a person of my generation that I feel made a very, very significant contribution. John Paul Borelli.
Oh, wow.
Because the person that actually turned John Paul Borelli on with me in your place was Booker T. Williams.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, could you elaborate on the music of these two individuals?
Well, John Paul more so than Booker T.
Okay.
But John Paul came to New York 17 years old. He was big, baby face. I knew he was a baby, but but he was not like dependent or seemingly vulnerable. You know, he wasn't tough. He, you know, but he came in and stayed with me maybe 6 months or more, maybe a year. You know, and he started. But the thing that was always serious about John Paul Borelli was he had the instrument under control at 17, and it was just a matter of him working and improving on that. And he was listening to all different kinds of music because all kinds of crazy people coming through that studio all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's there every day. Sometimes I wouldn't be there and he'd be absorbing all these different kinds of musicians. I mean, Dollar Brand would come through and rehearse, and Cecil, all kinds of different people would bring their bands through there. And he just absorbed all this, you know. And then one day he got ready and he said, I got me an apartment uptown on somewhere, not too far from where I'm living now, in fact, at 150. He found a place up there and didn't look back.
When you look at the way he plays compared to a lot of other guitarists, how do you feel his contribution to this, the evolution of the guitar is? Because that gets back to your thing about people were listening to rock and they're listening to, you weren't really, and you said you weren't really into that. But, you know, a lot of people, well, they came out of that with like, Elvin, let's go.
You were into that without wanting to be into that because it was surrounding you every day.
And John Paul was like that.
And John Paul definitely knew how to play funk, you know.
Right.
I mean, that was, you know, you come from Chicago, you know how to play the blues in many different forms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's part of your culture there, see. Now, you didn't see that as much in New York. When I came to New York, you almost had to go to find the blues. I mean, it's still kind of weird if you want to hear some real blues like you hear in the South and in the Midwest. It's hard to find that in New York.
Well, all I know is this. Based on my experiences in life, it's really an honor for me to have you two in my house.
Thank you for tuning in. In months ahead, you will have the opportunity to hear from many more Lost Generation artists and supporters. The audio-only version is available wherever you get your podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to hear upcoming episodes.